And if you would open your hands, palm up on your lap, just invite you to close your eyes now and choose one of your hands and just mentally place in that hand whatever you don't want to have in your life. Politically, socially, relationally, physically, emotionally, anything that you would like to get rid of in your life or to not have it be as strong as it is right now. And so holding that in your one hand, and now in your other hand, I invite you to mentally place in that hand what brings you joy and satisfaction, what brings you hope and laughter and contentment. Maybe you're placing people in that hand, or nature, or some part of your spiritual life, or music. But fill that other hand as fully as the one you did before with what you do not want. And now just very gently take your hands off your lap and empty both of those hands out so that you can be with all of that with a sense of balance. Yes, that is part of my life. Yes, I see that it is. And yes, I want to remain in the middle of all of that with a sense of calm, a sense of hope and encouragement, and a trust in my inner resiliency. Grant me the grace to accept what I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So, what is the purpose of equanimity or serenity? I think of serenity as kind of a sister of equanimity or a result of equanimity, of trying to find this balance in our life. For me, when I think about the purpose of equanimity, I think of it not just for myself, but I think of how then it can draw me forth to how I can be with others. So I think that equanimity allows us to be a resting place for the weary, a lighthouse for those who may feel lost, a comforting presence for the sorrowing, an island of hope for the hopeless, and a channel of love for people who are feeling loveless these days or unloved. So I'm coming for three basic questions, and not just for all of you, but for myself as well. And I think they're questions that we can ask ourselves every single day. You know, and they're all based on the Serenity Prayer. I think of any prayer that we ever pray these days, I think the Serenity Prayer is the most vital, truly, and I think it's what will keep us in balance. So the questions are, what in my life requires acceptance because it can't be changed? What in my life asks courage for me to change it? And where and how do I find the guidance to know the difference between changing and accepting? So I'm going to share with you six ways that I personally find equanimity in my life. Not that it's always there, but my attempts, I should put in there my attempts to find equanimity. And I was going over my talk yesterday, and I thought, you know, I'm a little hesitant to say I have six ways, because I remember Mary Kay Shanley and I when doing our writing retreats. And one time we did them, we invited the women to reflect on what women were mentors for their spiritual growth. And so I started off and I said something like, I'm going to share eight women's lives and how they're affecting my life. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and she said, when you said eight women, I thought we'll be here forever. You know? So I'm very hesitant to say six, but I will move through these so that by 10 after, we're finished with them. So the first one that came to my mind is willing to have some periods of silence and reflection. You know, we live in a hurry atmosphere in our Western culture, particularly in this country. But I truly believe that there's a river of peace, a river of calm that's there deep down inside of us, you know? And we just need to get there. But I know I can't get there if I'm always hurrying, or if I'm always thinking of the next thing I have to do. And so however we take those periods of silence, whether they're a daily meditation, whether they're going out for a walk, or you're doing some quiet drawing or painting, but something that we pause, you know, and we just get in touch with that presence of deep within ourselves. You know, a book I've gone back to so many times, I was thinking I need to get a new copy. And it's Thomas Kelly's A Testament of Devotion. Thomas Kelly was a Quaker. And he writes wonderful things in that book that inspire me. And this is one of the quotes. And this is on your quote page, so you'll know that. He wrote, "Deep within us all, there's an amazing inner sanctuary of the soul, a holy place, a divine center, a speaking voice to which we may continually return. It's a dynamic center, a creative life that presses to birth within us." So it's a dynamism. It's not just a silent kind of, you know, okay, there's this thing or this, you know, presence here, but there's a movement to this center that we have. It's solid, but it's like emanating outward, I guess, might be the way that I would say that. And I think we can find this presence anywhere, but to be attentive to it. One of the prayers that I pray every morning is taken from the Wisdom of Solomon, also called the Book of Sirach, I think. And it ends with a line that says, "Holy wisdom goes about seeking those worthy of her, graciously appears to them on the way, and goes to meet them with full attention." I love that last line, "and goes to meet them with full attention." And then I say, I want to meet you with full attention, you know, but I can't do that unless I'm really, you know, aware of it, aware of this love within me. So that's the first one. The second one is a biggie. Be willing to surrender. I remember having a great conversation in California with people there that were furious with me because I used the word surrender. Anyway, we got through all of that. We talked about it. Why is surrender so difficult for us to think about as Americans, you know? And I said, you know, we can use other words. We can say to release or to let go or to let be. But underneath it all, I can't manage everything. I cannot control everything, no matter how hard I try to do it. And so at some point, I'm going to have to do what the Serenity Prayer says. I'm going to have to accept what I can't change. I have to stop trying to fix everything because I can't fix everything. So I was trying to think of an example of this. I've been going back through some of my old journals, and this was from 2021. And I wrote this after I was driving up to Iowa, and I remember it was December, probably around Christmas time, and it had rained a lot instead of snowing, which was wonderful. But anyway, this happened to me. So I wrote, "It was like a small miracle, the most direct movement interiorly. Driving in heavy rain, a dull spirit, I said, 'Joy, I cannot find you, so you will have to come and find me.' You see, that's the moment of turning and saying, you know, I can't do this. I'm going to give it over to you. I looked up at that moment to see that the rain had let up. I saw the fields fresh with rain, mellow grasses on hillsides, and in that moment, my heart moved into joy, wonder at the beauty I beheld. I found myself smiling, overjoyed at the way this had happened. Once again, I learned to turn over what I cannot manage on my own, to call out, to trust, there's much more than what I know right now. And so I truly believe the best lesson I ever learned from Buddhism was when I was out studying at the Buddhist University in Boulder. And what I learned was one of their key foundational teachings, and it's called clinging and aversion. And clinging is to want to grasp so tightly whatever it is that I have. You know, and it can be an idea, it can be a building, it can be a person, but I hang on to it so tightly that my life is just controlled by the tightness of grasping that. And then the opposite is aversion, that I'm going to push out as hard as I can what I don't want to have, what you held in that one hand this morning. You know, I'm just going to do everything I can so it doesn't touch me. And of course, that doesn't go for if it's injustice and abuse and so on, but it's a way of being with it so that my energy goes not in the shoving away, but my energy goes toward, you know, being with what is there. I have a little side music right now, which is just okay. It gives me a chance to breathe. So after I learned this, I was reading a book by Tara Brach, B-R-A-C-H, I think is her last name, called Radical Acceptance. And what Tara Brach teaches is to say yes to things that disturb us, or say yes to things that that we don't want to have. And again, a person that's being abused would not be saying yes to that. But they might be saying yes to the emotions that are there, being with those emotions that are there. So I, you know, as with a lot of things, I start trying to practice this. And so I still remember the first time I was doing this, I thought, I was out in Arizona, I was given a retreat. And so I thought, I'm just going to say yes. And so it was fine. It was easy to say yes to everything on the retreat. But then I had this about 6 to 8 hour journey back to Des Moines. I had to, you know, a connection to make. And there was a storm going on, and so they had bumped, my seating was different because we had a different plane, and I was in a middle seat. I detest middle seats. I can't stand them. And especially because I'm small and it's like people always flowing over into my seat. And so anyway, but I said, I'm going to say yes to having a middle seat. And so I went into the airport and I thought, I'll say yes to this. So I plunked myself down in the middle seat, and sure enough, along came this guy that's about four times my size, and he has the aisle seat, and I said, okay, yes to this, and I was okay, and then I got out my book. I thought, I'm going to just read for this long flight, but he wanted to talk, and you know, people are boarding the plane. I thought, okay, yes to conversation. So then along comes this couple, and so I'm middle seat, he's aisle, and this one of the man had to sit here, and the woman had to go over in this middle seat she was assigned to. So I thought, oh, you know what, I'll get a middle seat anyway. So I said, well, you two want to sit together? Oh, yeah. So then they went over and they sat together. So then I was in the middle seat. I thought, yes to the middle seat over here. So then another couple came on the plane, and they had an aisle and a window seat. And so I graciously said, would you like to have my middle seat and sit together? And they said, that would be wonderful. And so I got my aisle seat after saying yes. So I know that it works. So yeah. So Angeles Arian writes in her book, The Fourfold Way, she says, you know, being detached, which is really what it is, it's I'm either clinging or aversion, I'm detached. In other words, I'm with it, but I'm not, you know, holding on or shoving it away. She said, it doesn't mean not investing in people and whatever we value, but what it means is to be open to the outcome of it. that it may not turn out the way that we want it to be. So, and Mary Oliver says, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things. I think this is it's a beautiful prayer. It's a poem, but I think it's a prayer. You need to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, in other words, really invest, to hold it against your bones, knowing your whole life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. I think of myself, I've always been a pretty high energy person, and I still am very grateful for good health, but I'll tell you, my physical energy is not what it used to be. And to let it go, let it be as it is, let myself be the person I am, it's really important. And if I don't, I'm going to get in trouble anyway, physically, to do that. So, okay, so the next thing, third one, is find the good within the not so good. And that has a lot to do, I think, if we can accept impermanence in our life, that life is always about adjustment. We're never the same when we get up the next day. Our cells have changed in our body. It's a different day. Today's a very different day than yesterday, weather-wise. Early this morning at 2 a.m, the husband of a real close friend of mine died. He was alive yesterday. She was married yesterday. She's a widow today. Life changes. It's impermanent. And so to find the good within the impermanent, or to find the good within what we consider the not so good. We stand upon the shifting sands of life, unpredictable and uncertain. We know this, yet too often we turn away from this simple truth in denial and fear. We know we cannot choose to have only lovely people in our life, perpetual delightful experiences, endless health and immortality. We know that our world can crumble in a moment. Peace could never be built upon avoiding life, or endlessly endeavoring to control the uncontrollable. So I'll give you an example of this, meeting the good within the not so good. Some of you know this. If you received my newsletter last fall sometime, I think it was. So last summer, it was July, and I wanted to go on my annual week-long retreat. And so I found a place in Minnesota near Collegeville, near a woman's retreat center, and there was a hermitage there. And the place was advertised as having a pond and, serenity and all of this. And I thought, that really sounds good. I'm going there. So I met with my spiritual director first, and the last thing she said to me was, meet God where God wants to be met. And I thought, oh yeah, of course, So I go off to my retreat, and the hermitage was lovely. They were right about that. So I got there kind of late in the day, and so I thought the next morning, I'm going to go. I expected the lake to be right in front of me, but it wasn't there. So I thought, well, I'll just walk through the woods, and I followed kind of the signs, and I got to the lake, and it was a swamp, and it was almost dried up. So I thought, okay, meet God where God wants to be met. So I walked back through the mosquito-laden woods in Minnesota. I get back to my hermitage, and I thought, well, I can do this. There was an oat field in front of me. It was, kind of getting ready to, it was end of July, so it was starting to ripen. Well, I sat down in the screened-in porch. I thought, this is great. And then a mile away is I-94 highway, and I heard the roar of traffic all day and sometimes into the night, so I thought, okay, meet God where God wants to be met. Well, they had a really bad windstorm a few days before, and branches were everywhere, and they had these little tractors, there were three of them. All day, they're gathering branches up. And the pile where they put them was like 4 car lengths from the hermitage. Oh my, I thought, this is going to be a long retreat. But then I remembered, meet God where God wants to be met. And I remembered that whole thing of finding good within the not so good. So I just said, I'm going to say yes to what's here. And I'll tell you, it was one of the best retreats I ever had because I grew to love that oat field. And I would watch in the morning when the sun first came across it, and at sunset when it would, the shadows that would happen. And I saw every day I'd go over and look at it, and the husk would open a little bit further as they ripened. It was just a wonderful experience for me. And it just taught me again that whole thing of, you know, finding the good within the not so good. So the fourth, I'm getting there. The fourth one is, remember that thoughts matter. I've learned a lot about this from quantum physics, you know, that we're made up, our, every part of us is made up of all these tiny invisible particles, photons of light and heat energy. And every thought I have goes out on some kind of electrical impulse. It goes out. It takes energy with it. Every emotion I have also has that energy. And so thoughts matter. One of the books I've recently read that I'll say a little more about in a minute is Hope Fitzgerald. She has a YouTube on this too, and the book, is, the tiny book is called The Infinity Wave. And she writes this in the early part of the book. Science uses such terms as the quantum field and string theory to describe the ever-moving interconnectedness of all things, although such oneness has been taught by spiritual leaders for years. Quantum physics is catching up. And you see, my thought isn't just going to go out. It's going to go to Paul. It's going to go to Kay. It's going to go to Mary Kay. It's going to go to Diane. You know, it's going out, and it's, so it's going to influence how it meets the energy in another person. You know, in us gathered here, you know, we are, I think, pretty much like-minded and heart-minded. But what if we had people whose thinking was very diverse from us and we were here together? How would that energy clash, or would it continue along a smooth way? And so where do I want my energy to go, and how do I want it to go? Those are really big questions, I think. Nan Merrill says, change your thinking and reality will also change. So I went again, I'll share an example of how this, I've been trying to practice this since Christmas time, and it's gonna be my Lenten practice, it is. Because I forget so easily that my thoughts and that this energy is going out. And what I love about the infinity wave, that I've often done loving kindness, which is send out love from myself. But with the infinity wave, it's in the shape of an eight, so that when that love goes out, it like boomerangs back to my own self. So I try to practice this. And so when I was getting the papers ready for today, my niece had made the notation for the Serenity Retreat, but it was on this great big paper, and my computer wouldn't shrink it down, so I took it to Office Depot. And when I got to the counter, I saw that the person there, this man, was very, really busy tending to things, and I thought, okay, I'm going to just practice the infinity wave so that whatever that man is doing, he's going to be calm, and it'll come back to myself, and I can be calm and wait instead of getting impatient. And so I waited about 10 minutes for him. And normally I would have been fidgeting, saying, oh, I'll come back later, or I'll, you know, do something else, or I'll look at my phone. And I thought, nope, I'm just going to send out love to this person back. So he came over, very friendly, says, I'll see what I can do with it. You know, so he went, and he worked about 10 minutes on it, trying to get it sized up and everything. And so when he came back, he brought it back with a smile, and I said, do I pay here or do I pay at the counter over there? And he said, oh, there's no charge for you today. I said, yes, this works. But honestly, that is not the motivation for doing this. So, but I think how we are with other people, we can influence how they are. I find it hardest when I'm with somebody who's really surly or very, you know, put offish. With it's a clerk or whoever, and that's really a challenge. And I have seen the energy change between us when I do this. It changes in myself to the better, and it changes in the other person, at least by their demeanor. Okay, the fifth one is, the chaos theory. And as Christians, you know, as a Christian for myself, I've known this for early on, as life, death, rebirth. This is what Lent reminds us of. I don't know how we ever got so caught up in Lent as a time to beat ourselves up and find out everything that's wrong with us and how sinful we are. Lent is really a time of hope, I think. It's a time to say, yes, there's more letting go to do. Yes, I have some growing to do probably. But you know what? That's not the end of the story. The story is life, death, and rebirth. And in the chaos theory, I think the chaos theory is so profound because we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the chaos that happened long ago in these stars that came together and they formed material, gases formed material, eventually formed our planet Earth, and eventually humans came into existence, and here we are today. So we're here because everything fell apart. Everything fell apart. It didn't look anything like it was before. And chaos is suffering. Chaos is hard. Chaos is sometimes giving up your life for something that you believe in. It's very difficult. I was thinking about Lent, and I thought about Jesus when he was on the cross and these people he'd given so much to, these disciples, these followers. Almost everyone stood at a far distance. Not one of them, I take it back, was there for him. But that was a time of great chaos. And who would have believed in that moment that later on, those people that stood at a distance would have a change of heart, that they would regain their hope, that they would have those teachings become so much a part of them that they could convince other people that those teachings were of value. And who would have thought that today, over 2,000 years, we're still remembering this person of great goodness named Jesus, who started it, you know, who was there beginning it. But a lot of chaos happened, you know, during that time. And right now, you know, we're in the season of spring, but so many things died in the fall. You know, they're going to come back in different ways, whether they're feeding the soil, whether they're growing. You know, they're going to grow again and produce flowers or seeds or fruits or vegetables or whatever. So I think that what's happening now, I know for myself, I feel like I'm in a time of suffering. And I don't like it. I wish everything could be all harmonious, calm. I wish I could easily wake up in the morning and just have everything be hopeful. But I wake up thinking very differently about that and needing to move toward what's happening. You know, one of the stories that Jesus told when this person asked him, "Who is my neighbor?" was a parable of the Good Samaritan. And in the Good Samaritan story that Jesus told, he says that the first two people that came to this man that was beaten up and wounded and needed someone to care for him, the first two crossed the road and went off on the other side. But he said the Samaritan came close to the man who was hurting. And, you know, so much emphasis is placed on the Samaritan was, you know, the immigrant, or the Samaritan was the outsider. But I think equally the importance of that parable is that he came close to what looked so hurt, so wounded, and did what he could about it. So that whole life, death, rebirth cycle. Mary Oliver has another poem called The Kingfisher, and she ends it with, "So long as you don't mind a little dying, how could there be a day in your whole life that doesn't have its splash of happiness?" But it's that little dying part that, you know, we don't like to have in there. So, yeah. Okay. So the sixth one is, the last one, is that we need a community of kinship and support. We simply cannot go it alone if we're going to have equanimity, if we're going to maintain and have a foundational balance. We need a community of kinship and support. That we know when we're with others, it might be just two people, it could be a large group, but we know when we're with them that we aren't standing alone in our beliefs and our values, and in our hopes and our longings and in our sufferings and in what's sorrowful for us. We know that others are there with us in it. You know, one of the things that I've loved is coming to the solstice and the equinox celebrations that are here. There's one coming up a week from Wednesday, isn't it, Carmen? Yeah. And when I come to these, I don't know a lot of the people that are here. I might know half. But I should say, and I love the experience of being in those rituals because there is an energy flow that's there. And I know, just like you're here today, you're here because you want to grow. You want to grow emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. It drew you here for that purpose, whether you would have named it exactly like that. And so when we come together in a group that's for ritual, celebration, for protest, whatever it might be, there's community there, and there's strength in community. And I know for myself that my hope can grow weak, and I need to have it supported again, and that's one of the ways to do it. And so I also think that we need, out of that community, that we need inspiration to believe in ourselves and our resiliency, to believe that we have the strength that we need. People who didn't give up, people who had hope in spite of not having hope. I thought about a whole lot of these people the other day. I'm going back to reading Anne Frank again, and I think, yes, this one woman died from her being confined and being treated as an other person, but her words have lived on. So many people today, if you look, go into the library, there are so many books for children for Anne Frank. Why do we have these? To encourage children to believe that they have that courage of the Serenity Prayer, that they have the ability to go on in times of suffering. What a wonderful young woman Anne Frank was, you know? And the life that went on comes after the life, death, rebirth, is the life she's given to other people today, how she's given it to me. I often go back and read Eddie Hillesum and Viktor Frankl, who also were at the time of the Holocaust. My favorite story in Man's Search for Meaning by Frankl is that story where they're out walking in the wintertime, and their boots have holes in the bottom. It's freezing. He is so weak, he hasn't eaten. They didn't give him anything in the morning. They have to march a long distance. And he wants to die. He thinks, I can't go on anymore. This is it. He saw all these other people give up. He's going to give up. And then he looks up and he sees this tiny light in the distance. It's a light in a farmhouse. And he said in that moment, he knew he would live. He said that light gave him hope, that he could do what he had to do. And I love that story because sometimes we just have that little glimmer of light, and it may come not in a farmhouse, but it may come from another person. It may come from something we read. You know, we don't know. It may come from something we see in nature that just lifts our spirit. But we need people to remind us of that. I thought of Bishop Marion Budd recently. You know, the courage to speak up to power. She just said to me again, yes, we can do this. We have to not be fearful of doing this. I thought of Jane Goodall. Jane Goodall is in her late 80s, and she still flies over 200 flights a year to speak to people about the environment and to encourage people to do what they can, you know, to preserve our planet. And a week ago, well, just this past Sunday, I went to listen to Bishop Seitz from El Paso, and to hear him talk about his experience with the immigrants who come across the border. He was so inspiring, and you can be sure that he does not receive all positive responses from his talks, and you know, personally in letters and so on. It's a difficult journey for him. He goes all across the country, plus being bishop in his own El Paso diocese. And these are people who you know, are willing to go beyond self. In our Circle of Compassion group, we recently read a book called Rough Sleepers, and it's about homeless people in Boston. And Dr. Jim O'Connell, from the time that he finished his medical preparation, he immediately went into the streets of Boston. He spent his whole life on the streets of Boston. And it was not an easy thing for him to do, I mean, for many reasons. But he went on to establish clinics for the people there, establish ways for them to be able to get help. More than anything, I loved his attitude toward people. And what that book said to me, and this is part of community, is that it's not me and them, it's not us and them, but we're one in this. I read a reflection, you know, I'm always being challenged to grow. There's a reflection the other day in a daily devotional I have, Give Us This Day. And I think Richard Reese was a person that wrote it. And he was talking about kind of our Lenten journey and the things that keep us apart from others. And I'd never thought about this. He said, we separate ourselves from others in so many ways by our language, calling people aliens, by how we physically separate ourselves from others, and how we mentally or how we approach others. And he said, for instance, we live in a first world, and then there's second world, and there's third world people. And I'd never thought about how I put people in the hierarchy of greater and lesser. And our language can betray us. And it really called me to think about that again. So we need people to inspire us. And we also then need people who will support us in our hard times. My friend I mentioned, whose husband just died, she said that her greatest support right now are the loving people who had gathered around her. You know, arts, extended family, extended family, friends who are there in this time of great need. And again, I went back to Lent and I considered, you know, the three that stood at the foot of the cross. If we even have one person that stands at the foot of our cross, it can make a tremendous difference. One person that understands what I'm going through, and if doesn't understand, wants to be there anyway. So, a couple more little things, and then we're going to take a break. So I think out of community, then, gives us hope. For my friend, it's the hope that she will make it through all the grief and sorrow that's to follow her husband's death, and she can do it. And she knows she can, because these people are there supporting her. And so I thought about what gives me hope out of community. And I thought of one of my stories that I've liked so much is in Judy Scanato's book. I think it's in Fields of Compassion. It might be in her second book. But she tells the story of, you know, during the Cold War and when the Berlin Wall was so strong and it was separating East and West Germany, and there was so much division going on, and people were really suffering in East Germany. And one little group of people, church group, got together one night, and they started talking about what it was like. And one person said, what will it be like when the Berlin Wall comes down? Now, everybody there could have said, it's not going to come down. Look how long it's been there. Look what's happening between Gorbachev and the United States. But no, they had a conversation about what will it be like when the Berlin Wall comes down. They got so enthused about that that they told other people, and pretty soon all over Germany, people were meeting around the question, what will it be like when the Berlin Wall falls down? What is our question today? You know, what's our question today? And I've often thought I would love to, but I don't have the energy, but I'd love to start a program across the country called Houses of Hope. And people would meet. They'd meet weekly for a short time, maybe an hour, hour and a half, and they'd all bring something that deepened their hope, strengthened their hope, a story, something about kindness, maybe something they saw or something within themselves. But the question, you know, how can we maintain hope in what seems a hopeless time? Maybe that's the question, but I just think those kind of things are so important. And then in the National Geographic, 2 months ago, I read this powerful story about in the state of Washington, there were four dams there, and they were killing the whole area. The indigenous tribes that lived there used to fish in those waters. The salmon weren't there anymore. The river that used to, you know, fertilize the soil, that river, all of it was all, you know, dammed up and so confined. They worked for 22 years. They never gave up. They kept meeting in community. And finally, I think it was just last year that all those dams were destroyed and the rivers flowing free again for the first time in all that time. One of my favorite people that I shouldn't say favorite people, one of the people that most inspires me, certainly is a favorite inspiring person, is John Lewis. Because he's more in our modern time. I mean, we can go to times when of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and all of the people that worked to end slavery. But the civil rights movement would never have happened without community. You know, this morning I thought about a sister in my community left her teaching in Detroit, got on a bus and went down to Selma and marched with those people, knowing how dangerous it was. You know, that was such a turning point in the civil rights movement. And so she did that in the community of people that were on that bus and so on. So, okay, just about done here. I'm gonna read one more little thing to you and then continue on. So I wanna read this as a closure for this part of it. This is by a woman whose name is L.R. Knost, K-N-O-S-T, and it's in your paper, so you don't need to look at it right now. But I just want to read this for us. Here's to the bridge builders, the hand holders, the light bringers, those extraordinary souls wrapped in ordinary lives who quietly weave threads of humanity into an inhumane world. They are the unsung heroes and heroines in a world at war with itself. They are the whisperers of hope that peace is possible. Look for them in this present darkness. Light your candle with their flame, and then go. Build bridges, hold hands, bring light to a dark and desperate world. Be the hero and heroine you're looking for. Peace is possible. It begins with us. And I would say equanimity is possible. It begins with us. Let's close by reading the three affirmations together. May I embrace change with stillness and calm. May I deeply accept this moment as it is. May my heart be a home of balance and spaciousness. And may it be so. Amen.